Hello and welcome to the Geek and Review Podcast. I'm Jeremy Pappas, alongside, as always, Russell Jones. I choose you!
Did you have to use the Master Ball to catch me, though? Because that's That's the only thing I care about is how
you didn't. You didn't even shake the ball once.
God damn it. I just crawled into the damn thing like I lived there, didn't I?
I actually missed. I hit a rock. It popped open. You crawled into the ball and closed it over the top of you.
I'm so awful. I really am.
But don't worry. I saved you from getting your ass kicked by a Rattata. Oh my god, is that your... I'm so close to your house!
So what you're saying is I'm basically Psyduck.
Oh no, Psyduck, you at least had to walk to water.
Ugh.
You're like a one-winged Pidgey.
God. I am the Brita of Pokemon. I think we've established.
The Pokemon.
I'm Brita of Pokemon. Damn it all.
How you doing? That may be the most ridiculous thing we've ever played.
We have heights of ridiculousness that have not been summited yet.
Decent
week. It's been kind of a nutty week. I'm glad, partially, that I don't have a console that I could be playing GTA Online on.
Yeah.
Because I still wouldn't be playing GTA Online, apparently.
Well,
but still.
Right, and we can talk more about GTA Online, which just launched on the 1st, which is when everything else crazy happened. Yeah. It launched on the 1st. We could talk more about that a little bit later in the podcast if we get it. But I did have a really great idea that I have been telling my friends that played GTA, because I don't have a console and I'm obviously not going to be playing it. But I did have a really great, I think really funny idea that if you do play GTA 5, I would like you to do and record yourself doing and then put it on the internet so that I can laugh at it. Here's what you do. When you're online and you're in co-op and you're doing robberies, right? If you yell at the guy that you're robbing, he goes faster. You know this. Did you know this?
Okay.
If you yell at the guy, because if you don't yell at the guy, he pulls the money out slowly, and he may hit the alarm, and by the time you're finished getting the money and he throws the bag at you, then you're at 2 stars and you have to really run away. But if you yell at him, you make him go faster. In your headset, you legitimately have to yell at him with your own voice of your person. You're actually yelling at him. I found that really interesting too. But the most interesting thing is, I think, and the thing that's the funnest is that obviously it doesn't know what you're yelling. It's like you're talking to your dog.
It's just
if
volume.
You talk to your dog at a certain volume. The dog, if you talk to him in a certain tone of voice, you can say terrible things to your dog, and he's like, oh my god, this guy loves me. Or you can say really nice things to your dog, and he, like, cowers. It all depends on your tone of voice. Well, the game's a lot like that, too. So I've been telling my friends that play GTA 5, and there are many of them, and they're really loving the game, that if it were up to me and I were going to be doing this, I would yell at the clerks as I was robbing them, but I would yell really complimentary things.
You have a very nice blouse!
That shirt is very appealing on you!
I think you have qualities of a manager!
And just
have you considered going vegan?
Just thinking about it makes me laugh.
Just grabbing the money, shoving in there. Oh god, I can't take this. No, stop, please.
I support all American small business owners! Just think of the most polite things you could say to people. And like when they throw you the money, of course you have to end with, thank you, have a nice day! and then walk out.
This has been a very pleasing transaction, would rob again, 5 stars!
So I want somebody to do that, and you can claim it was your idea all you want, but I want somebody to do that. And
we give you open Creative Commons license
because it's to me, I just want to see, because I've seen gameplay footage of actual, you know, robberies taking place, and I just want somebody to do that. So do that and shoot it to me via email or via Twitter, and I will share it far and wide because that sort of thing makes me laugh.
I remember after it launched. One of the guys that I've podcasted with and done some other stuff with, Max over at the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette, who does reviews and stuff for them for video games, was complaining on Twitter that his car disappeared. Like, he had a car in, you know, the car thief's neighborhood, the kind of rough area of town. And it was a modded out, you know, he spent money on this car. It was a nice car, and he put it in the garage. The car disappeared. And he was pissed. And the thing is that it was a bug that caused the cars to disappear, and they've since fixed the bug. But when he mentioned it on Twitter, I sent him a reply that said, Rockstar says it's not a bug, but a feature. This is a rough neighborhood and a game about crime, yo. Which is, and he replied like, oh, like, wait, is that true? I was like, no, troll.
That I don't know. If I were Rockstar, I would totally have NPCs stealing your shit. That's the best thing ever.
Absolutely, yeah. That's
the best thing ever.
You get a little thing on your phone. It's like the car alarm. Your LoJack on your car is going, wait, boop, boop, wait, boop, what? Boop. They stole? God damn it all. I think you've got to run to the other side of the map.
Especially in the middle of it. Well, not like you'd actually run. You just steal somebody else's car. But especially if, like, you're in the middle of a robbery.
Yeah.
And then you walk outside and your car's been jacked.
Apparently, the other trend that has emerged from Grand Theft Auto V are selfies. Because you have the cell phone in game, which you know has been kind of a thing in the past. That's how you interact with the menu and various other blah blah blahs. Mm-hmm. But apparently, you can use the phone now to take selfies, and so there are lots of people that are taking selfies of their GTA 5 characters
inappropriate selfies.
Well, no, just taking any pictures. Like there, and I've seen some decent ones. Like there was a GIF where someone put two of their characters in suits. And there's a UFO behind them. Uh-huh. It's like, look into the light, click, it was a blimp all along.
Yeah, I found a whatculture.com thing on the best selfies in GTA 5, which is pretty funny. Yeah, you just take selfies of yourself.
Yeah, honestly, that is hilarious. Considering the tone of the game and considering, you know, kind of where it's set and the kinds of stuff that it lampoons, I'm not surprised. I'm not surprised in the least.
You know, say what you will about Rockstar, but they really do think of very just flat out clever things to do.
Yeah.
They really do go the clever route more often than not, and it's appreciated, I think. It's very much appreciated by most people. So last week we discussed doing a little bit on the D&D Next playtest, which they've released the playtest, the final playtest document on. Actually, they released the final playtest document, and in the playtest document, they basically said there was going to be another playtest document because they didn't do anything from the previous version to the Druid and the Paladin, I want to say, because they were still working on certain aspects. I happen to be playing a Druid in our D&D playtest game, so I've been checking back and forth to see if when they're going to release the final version. They have yet to do that, but they posted yesterday on Wizards posted on their Facebook page yesterday that the final version was out, and I was thinking, of course, oh, the final version, right?
Right.
It was the same final version that's been out the whole time.
Yeah, they're just amping up the interest or the. They're trying to amp up the interest.
Yeah, so I completely re-downloaded it, all ready to get new Druid goodness. And, yeah, nope. Ah, well. But eventually it'll come out. We have been playing now, what, for 2 months? We really started in the, what would you say, the second-to-last playtest? Third-to-last playtest?
The packet right before this one was what we started with, and we did that for about 2 or 3 sessions, and then we switched on to this recent packet on the last session. Uh-huh. And I'm overall pleased with the changes that were made from that packet to this one. Just the previous packet, here are my concerns overall that we're running into and seeing in certain circumstances. There are some classes who have iconic, clear things that they can do at first level that make them feel like their class. Notably the Rogue, because the Rogue is a lethal killing machine.
Mm-hmm.
Because they get the sneak attack whenever they get combat advantage, or, you know, advantage. And there are so many ways now to get advantage, because it's kind of a binary thing, you know? in almost every circumstance, almost everything works off of advantage, which is nice.
It works really well. Advantage or disadvantage. Yes,
exactly. Advantage or disadvantage. So it's like, do you have advantage? Yes. Okay. Here are things that work for you. Do you have disadvantage? Here are bad things. And I like that personally. I think that that's, you know, it's good design. I think I'm enjoying it. It's one of the things that I really liked about the Avenger from 4E that they are now kind of, you know, moving all over the place. It's good.
Well, I would say the great thing that they've done about it, and we've discussed this previously on the podcast, is the issue with the Rogue. Yes. In third edition, the Rogue pretty much existed only to get sneak attack damage, which meant they had to get, what did they call it? They had to get, they had to be flanking.
Flanked.
Essentially, there wasn't a name for that condition. No. They expanded that a little bit in 4th edition, which is when I believe they started calling it advantage.
Right. I remember in 3rd edition, it was defined as they got sneak attack any time that the target
was denied,
their dexterity bonus to their AC.
Right, which was essentially like,
congratulations, here are overall problems with 3rd edition in a nutshell.
Yeah, which apparently which was really only when they were flanked or when you had
you caught them flat-footed.
Flat-footed. Damn, I can't remember these old 3.5.
Yeah, you catch
in
them flat-footed.
In 4th edition they fixed that a little bit, but it was still a rogue thing. I think what they've done now is they've kind of made that a full game thing, which is interesting. I being a designer, I had always thought that they would find a way to do away with that. And quite the opposite. They've expanded it, and I think it works really well. It's a very creative solution to that, well, the rogue only ever wants to have advantage over, or only ever wants to flank somebody. So you would have rogues, and necessarily, on their part, you would have rogues that would basically, you know, lie, cheat, and steal to be flanking somebody.
Yeah.
No matter what it did to anybody else. And it was really annoying playing a wizard because the rogue seemed to always be right in the middle of where you wanted to do stuff. So, yeah, it's one of those sorts of things.
The thing with the rogue is that they do it really, really well, and they take advantage of that mechanic in a way that not only is, you know, iconic for them, but is very effective at getting stuff done. The other classes, not so much,
not
especially the fighter.
Yeah, well, I would say especially the class that I'm playing, the druid. The druid at first level is really not much different than the wizard at first level. Or the cleric at first level, there's literally, now again, they still have to make changes and what have you, but in the final playtest packet, the druid at first level is just a regular guy. I mean, just a spellcaster.
There is so much of reliance on the basic attack now that any class that doesn't have a way to modify that basic attack from first level, like the rogue does...
Right.
Is real. It really feels like, you know, I'm just hit points, and that's it. There's nothing else really on a constant basis that makes them feel, because what are you going to do most of the time, arguably? You're going to spend most
basic
of the time attacking.
Attack, right.
Right, basic attack. So if you don't have something that works off of that basic attack, then what else do you have other than just, here, I'm going to use my action surge to get another action. Once.
Mm-hmm.
Period.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe I'll get it again next session.
Yeah. And I mean, and
I'm a wizard.
I
have these spells. And so when wizard spells are a completely, you know, they're a separate type of mechanic. They're separate from the basic attacks.
Right. But they have done for things like the wizard. The wizard can take a cantrip at first level that basically gives them a more magic-y attack that never runs out.
Right.
The cleric is the same way. The cleric can do an attack at first level that they can do all the time that will never run out. Fighter doesn't really get that.
Yeah.
I go back to the druid because that's what I'm playing. The druid doesn't really get that. There's a ranged cantrip at first level that you can use, but it literally deals like 3 points of damage.
Yeah.
It's just entirely pointless.
Now, there is a, and I'll actually argue that point for just 2 seconds, because as a DM, I know what the hit points for a lot of these things have, especially at first level. 3 hit points will kill darn near half the stuff you run across.
Well, that's true, but when you compare that to just using a melee basic attack, it's nowhere close. It's true. Not, I mean, it's below what the low end of the damage of a melee basic attack would be.
Yes.
So there's really no comparing. I mean, sure, three, but it doesn't do an automatic three damage. You still have to roll, you know, shit for it.
No, yeah. And that's, I think that's kind of, you know, from a balance perspective where you gotta figure out on the design, if you have to roll and you have a chance to miss, then the payoff better be worth that risk. Because otherwise, if you're giving me just a little tiny amount of payoff, then why am I rolling? They should hit.
Right. I should at least be guaranteed the little bit of damage I'm going to do.
Right. I am leery of a few spells such that rely overly much in some circumstances on saving throws for monsters, because like the Sacred Fire for clerics. And again, playtesting, like beta testing, you don't know if this is going to be the way that it winds up. This is just, you know, impressions and discussions of various things. And in this case, it's the mechanic of, okay, the player does nothing. They just check for range, and then the monster has to make a roll to see if it saves or fails. If it fails, then it takes damage. If it saves, nothing happens. Mm-hmm. And that's a first level, you know, Orison at the moment that the clerics can just use constantly, and they tend to do, because it's D8 fire damage. That's right. Good.
That's,
you know,
pretty
possibly
good.
Possibly good damage.
Yeah.
But the character, aside from rolling damage, does nothing. They could say, okay, I'm going to cast Sacred Fire. Roll. Nothing happens. Okay, then my turn's done.
And what?
You know, there's no tension on the player side, because even though we're talking about feelings at the table that are fun and that promote, you know, that promote you doing things.
Right.
Getting dice in your hands and rolling it creates an emotion and is active. It's an action. You feel like you're actually doing stuff. Instead, you just say, I'm going to attack with Sacred Fire, and everything else except the damage roll is handled by the DM.
Mm-hmm.
Moving that, I think, I don't know how I feel about it. Because on the one hand, it's a very simple mechanic.
Mm-hmm.
All I do is I roll and I add, you know, whether it's dex, whether it's con, you know, whatever the mod is for the monster, and boom, done. But on the other hand, the player is not really as active as they are in other ways.
Right, and it doesn't really achieve a function. I mean, it could essentially be like an attack roll that has the same modifier that you have to hit.
It's just that the DM is making the
right,
roll.
Right, the DM is making the roll instead of the player, which is, I think you bring up a very good point. Well, do you necessarily want to take all of the rolling away from the players? Do you want to give all that rolling to the DM?
And that's one of the things that Monty Cook specifically brought up with Numenera that just came out. All the stuff is done by the players. The DM is not doing any of those actions. Mm-hmm. If the monster is attacking the players are rolling to try to avoid.
Mm-hmm.
If the players are attacking the monsters, the players are rolling to hit. You know, there, it's more than just that. But the actual active part of it is being taken by the players. That also means that the math is being done by the players. And in a lot of ways, the argument for that is that it takes less work for the DM and gives more work to the players. It gives the players more to do, and that makes it, in some ways, you know, more fun, quote unquote, for the players.
Mm-hmm.
So whether or not, you know, that really makes it through, we've seen Sacred Fire in this mechanic kind of make it through a few playtest packets. It'll probably be the way that it winds up, you know, going in. But
right.
There are still, once this last public playtest packet is kind of, you know, done with Wizards, they're going to still do development on their own to finish stuff up. So, you know, there's still stuff going on behind the scenes. There's still feedback that's going to come from this. And to me, that level of feedback is the most important kind of feedback that you can give as a player.
Mm-hmm.
You can say, my character at first level feels like a guy with a hammer. It does not feel like a fighter. It does not feel like a druid. It literally feels like someone with a d20 and a hammer that gives me 1d6. There is nothing that distinguishes me from other characters.
Right.
That's an important thing. And in this playtest packet, fighters got their fighting style back. They could choose to be, you know, a weapon fighter, a ranged fighter, a shield fighter. And I think that is a very important thing. Yes, you want to try to make it simple, and you want to present simple options for people to come in and join, you know, join the game and play the game. The human fighter was described early on in the playtest process, in the design process, as that most basic, simple. If you wanted to go in and you wanted to tell the video game, I want to play at the basic introductory level, you would be given a human fighter because it's easy.
Mm-hmm.
But, and that means there's also less options to confuse you, kind of the way that like a wizard and spellcaster would. On the one hand, here's a fighter, here's a thing, hit something.
Right.
You're done. Here's a wizard. Here are all the spells that you can choose from, and they're situational. You may want to cast mm-hmm. this here, that there. There are all these mechanics that work around them, and you know, it's complexity versus simplicity. However, that simplicity does not have to mean straight, you know, generic lack of any options altogether.
Right. I would say that, and I understand their reasoning behind wanting to do a class that is simple to play. However, classes, I think, across really any game that you go into, be it a video game, be it a tabletop RPG, from Pathfinder to 4th edition D&D to 13th Age, the classes that players are allowed to choose from first level should be equal. Not equal numerically. They should be equal in what I'll call the fun quotient, which is something it's easier to make classes equal numerically. It's still incredibly fucking difficult. Don't get me wrong. That's still a really hard thing to do.
Yeah.
But that fun quotient thing is very important to actually get done. Now, it's much even harder than trying to make things numerically equal.
Yeah.
I would argue you don't want a class that's that simple and make it the starting class, because then you've relegated fighter, which in my mind is one of the things you have to have in your game. You've relegated fighter to baby shoes. To, oh, that's the meh class. That's the, it's the, you know, if you've ever played a free-to-play MMO and you actually choose to pay to play it.
Yeah.
There are the characters who are clearly going by, or if you've ever joined a website where you have the basic account and the pro account, and the pro account can do various things the basic account can't do. The basic account's basically just to look around.
Yeah.
It's like that. The fighter is the basic account, and that shouldn't be a part of your game. If you're going to get a new player in, you should create all of your classes in such a way that a new player can say, hey, I want to play this, and it's understandable enough, or it's alterable enough to be understood that, but it's still fun, and they can still do things, and they can still get it. To me, that doesn't give the real flavor of D&D, and I'm glad that I'm seeing with the fighter, they're giving the fighting styles, they're putting all that forward. I've bitched a lot about druids, but they've said we're gonna release more information on druids, so I'm only really bitching about a version of the druid that I'll go and say just doesn't exist anymore. Yeah. We just don't have the specific rules to make it not exist.
Right. What I'm reminded of when we talk about, you know, introductory and complexity and blah, blah, blah. When I first showed Macy how to play WoW, and I was playing and she wanted to have a character, she was looking at different things. She said, oh, Warlock looks interesting. And she'd never played MMOs before. And I said, I don't know if you would enjoy the Warlock because it's really complex. That was the wrong thing to say.
Yeah, it was.
Because the tone from that was, oh, you wouldn't understand.
Right.
Or, oh, it's too hard for you. Head pat. Here, go over here and play with the, you know, the little kids' things. And she took offense at that, as rightly she should have. Uh-huh. And she really buckled down and got the Warlock and learned it and played it and, you know, was a progressive era raiding Warlock for quite some time. So
sometimes even smart guys say stupid things.
Well, I would say that happens to me quite frequently. As if you listen to the last 10 seconds of every of our podcasts, you will find that that proves itself a lot. But the thing is, if the player wants to play the game, mm-hmm. they will learn it. They will learn it. If they come in and they say, you know, I think that you have more chance of doing harm if they come in and say, I want to play the game. Ooh, magic sounds like really fun. I want to play something magic-y. Okay, it's your first time playing. Here's a fighter. But it's not magic-y, but it's easy and you'll learn it.
Right.
But I want to, you know, I think that you can make classes at early levels easier to understand and not overloaded.
Right.
Certain classes might be easier to learn than others. I mean, Rogue is pretty darn easy. With the addition of skills, there's a little more complexity added in, but it's still pretty darn easy.
Mm-hmm.
You attack. You are going to deal a ton of damage if you, you know, put yourself in the right position, but you are a little, you know, softer than the fighter as a result. The fighter is a little heavier. It doesn't necessarily deal as big damage as you deal, but it deals consistent damage.
And it's important to explain that, I think. It's important to let... Because you can do a lot of things and have a reason behind a class, but it's important that you, as a designer, communicate that reason to players so they know what they're getting into. If I just tell you... Well, if I tell you, okay, fighter, you have an immediate, you know, thought in your mind. But if you've never played D&D before, the thought in your mind might be completely different. And while reading across the fluffy description of the fighter in the book might give you a little bit of a better idea, it's not necessarily mechanically the thing you want to do. I look at it like this. I am not, as a DM, not super secretive about things that I do. I like to make sure my players know things. If I think players are going, are traveling down a rabbit hole that at the end of it is just not going to be fun for them, I'll just flat out tell them, listen, there's nothing for you there. Or if they're trying to solve a problem that's by its very nature unsolvable, like blowing up a Death Star, I will tell them, that's not something that you're going to be able to do.
Mm-hmm.
I'm reminded of a moment in the Acquisitions Incorporated, the very first Acquisitions Incorporated podcast, where they were playing, they were playing, and one of the players, it was either Gabe or Tycho, you find out halfway through that they thought that the picture on the front of the monster manual was going to be at the end of the dungeon they were in. Of course, the picture on the front of the 4th edition monster manual is
Dragon.
Orcus.
Oh, the Orcus, the monster manual, not the DM's guide.
Yeah, the Orcus.
I have the DM's guide as my background on my phone, so I see it every single day.
Yeah, it's not a red dragon, it's Orcus.
Yeah.
Needless to say, at the end of the 1-3 level dungeon, Orcus does not lurk.
Yeah.
So they say, oh no, he's not at the end of the... But that's always been something that stuck with me, where as a D&D player, I look at that and go, oh, Orcus, that's a 30 level, you know, speaking in third edition parlance, that's a 30th level, you know, elite creature that I will likely never encounter. It's like a lore figure from WoW.
And that's kind of, to a point, that's kind of disappointing.
Well, it's not necessarily disappointing. They've given us the stuff.
You never fought Orcus. It's not disappointing.
Well, it's not really disappointing in that it's not that they say you're not allowed to encounter Orcus. It's that in the games that I play, I've never gotten anywhere near 30th level.
Right.
Either because I haven't played a game for 4 years straight, though I got close.
Yeah.
And that's playing like practically every single day, or because I don't start off at 25th level when I play the game. If I want to do a heroic campaign and fight Orcus, I could. I mean, that's not a problem.
Yeah.
But
yeah,
I know that that's more of a, in my games, the way I like to play, I don't necessarily like stuff like that. So I'm likely never going to be in the situation where I'm going to try to hit Orcus and I'm going to miss hitting Orcus, because he's a statue, not a guy.
But it's when I talk about disappointment, I mean in terms of, I've been playing D&D since I was about 15, and having done so for, well, actually, you know what, half my life now, having done that, I miss a little bit of that wonder and uncertainty of looking at
absolutely.
That and that seeing the massive thing and saying, holy crap, that looks insane. Could I, you know, what are the chances of me running into that? Do I need to prepare for that? That thing is out there and it's going to eat me if I don't, you know, if I don't eat my adventurer Wheaties.
Right.
And there's a guy in our, we're playing a 13th Age game locally. It's kind of off and on. But there's a guy in there who has that wonder. I think he also smokes a lot of weed, but he still has that.
Weed, wonder, really the same thing when you get down to it.
But, you know, we go in and we're playing the game, and I'm from a, you know, high-level perspective. I'm looking at it from the sense of, okay, you know, we're going to do this thing, and we're going to get this MacGuffin, and we're going to go here, and we're going to get this, and this is the long view of the campaign, so these are the things that kind of need to be done, because, you know, it's the thought of, we're going to fight goblins at early level, we're going to fight,
you know
elite monsters, but that's kind of the weft and the wheel of it, you kind of get it, you know, and that sense of the mystery does not exactly happen every day for the jaded long-term player. You can't look at the monster manual and look at it and not think, holy crap, I could face that thing tomorrow, it could just burn down my village, and you know, is that what's going to happen in my game? And yes, DMs can pull that kind of stuff off, but from a normal, what you can kind of expect, just running the game kind of as it's written in the book, as a starting point at least, and especially the practical standpoint of, realistically, how often is this group going to be able to meet? Are we really going to realistically be able to turn a full 30-level campaign without, you know, some crazy skipping here and there? I mean, that's the kind of thing that sometimes I kind of miss that wonder, that sense of what could be, that unknown. PvP right now, or actually not PvP comic, the Table Titans comic that they're doing, that's kind of a send-up comic for D&D Encounters. There's a character in there, Drawzu, who is his character. It's a brand new guy to D&D, and he spelled his wizard's name wizard backwards. And he's the same way. He's looking at all this going,
wait a minute.
That was awesome.
Why didn't I ever think of that?
Of just spelling your name backwards.
Of just spelling wizard backward. Because
anagrams.
Because
yeah,
when
anagrams
you said Drawzu, I was like, my brain immediately went, yeah, that's an acceptable D&D name.
It's wizard backwards.
Right, it's just wizard backward.
Yeah,
that just blew my mind a little bit. I can't believe I've never thought of that.
And the thing is that's what happened all the time with
early
level.
In the early days, that's what would happen.
Like Robilar and all the, you know, Zagig and a couple of others. I mean, you go back and you look at and you really look up like the first edition or the early, you know, Gygaxian era characters, their names. That kind of stuff happened all the time. I mean, Voldemort, you know, Harry Potter. I won't say it's a common trope, but it happens. It's a tropey, you know. Not enough that it feels overly done, but you could certainly, you know, that's something you put in your back pocket and you hang on to. It's like I'm stuck on a name. Anagram it. Done. My name's Fighter. Oh, I'm Grift. Grifter.
Grift.
I'm Grift. You know?
I'm gonna spell all the class names backward.
There you go. But, you know, that's the kind of wonder occasionally that I miss sometimes playing D&D a lot. Like playing regular Wizards of the Coast, whatever stamped D&D. Which I think is the reason why I tend to be a bit of a promiscuous gamer.
You're trying to recapture that.
Well, yeah, I pick up, and that makes it sound even worse now. But, you know, I try a lot of different games and a lot of different things because, that sense of wonder and that sense of unknown or unknowing is, I think, one important thing that you can get in D&D. I mean, when we're playing, we just started the Eberron game. With my original D&D playtest group, and they are now doing 4th edition because that's what they wanted to play because, you know, D&D Next just wasn't giving them enough of what they wanted. And describing Eberron to them, setting everything up, running things that I am very familiar with because I'm almost an Eberron scholar, doing all that and throwing that stuff in front of them and just seemed to be like, holy crap, this is wicked crazy. We've got to deal with these things. And why is the sky burning? And, you know, what the hell is going on? You know, that kind of stuff I like to see happen, which is why I like the DM, but also why I like to go try out lots of different games that are out there.
Mm-hmm.
Edge of the Empire, you know, that system is nice, but the setting is very well-trod territory.
It's very familiar.
And what you expect to have in Edge of the Empire or in a Star Wars game is very familiar. We have so far managed our, you know, complete and total pogrom on Force users because we wound up with a Force user, but he hasn't really used his Force abilities a whole lot.
Uh-huh.
But, you know, I kind of miss that.
Yeah.
And I'm a little bit looking forward to D&D Next for that specific reason. Because you read – I got Ghost of Dragonspear Castle.
Mm.
Josh picked it up for me when he went to Gen Con. And reading through it, it's bringing back a lot of lethality that has been missing in certain games. Like there are curses that stay with you, that can kill you, that you just can't get rid of at the drop of a hat. Petrification? Oh, it can happen. It can happen a lot. Dragging your friends, you know, dragging your buddy's petrified corpse out of the dungeon in a cart so you can wheel him either to a stonemason to get rid of that god-awful porn stash that he just will not refuse to get rid of, or to a cleric to get him depetrified, you know, and eventually learning the ability to do it yourself at a higher level. I mean, those are the kind of things that when you hear old school players that are decrying and bemoaning, you know, the next and the new and the whatever, that's kind of, I can understand and empathize with some of those feelings. I don't necessarily think that it means everything new is bad and that everything old is good. It's just the wonder is something that I always try to recapture whenever possible. And I know that's kind of running us off topic from some of the stuff that we were talking about with the playtest, but there is some newer things that have been coming out. If you really want to get a look behind the screen at what's going on with Wizard of the Coast and with the designers, with D&D Next, go read Mike Merle's Legend and Lore columns that he posts over at the Official Wizards website. The most recent one that I think Jeremy, I don't know if Jeremy's read this or not.
I haven't.
Class groups is a discussion that they're having and that they're asking people to chime in about.
Which I really liked in 4th edition. I liked the power. One thing I really liked about 4th edition was I liked the different the power sources. I thought that was a good thing.
You have, you know, arcane power and divine power, and those you could expect certain things from them because that was where they got their stuff from. This is thematically broader but similar. Instead of, you know, power sources, they just have four basic categories that classes can fall into. Warriors are masters of arms. They are tougher than other characters. Tricksters are experts in a variety of fields. Masters or mages. Mages specialize in arcane magic. Priests specialize in divine magic.
Mm-hmm.
But you can have different kinds of priests. You know, you can have different kinds of mages. You can have different kinds of tricksters. Monks, for instance, he mentioned in the article that they're part of their discussion that they're having is which column monks fall into. And I think they've decided that they fall into the warrior category because the primary thing that winds up defining the monk is unarmed strike.
Right.
That is, you know, that's something that I think is worth looking at, especially, and if you're trying to get your voice heard, but you can't necessarily be involved in a playtest game, go look at those columns and chime in on there. Because we were discussing this when we were kind of getting ready for this podcast. Mm-hmm. And honestly, given the broader view now of all the different playtest documents, of all the different, you know, things that they've been doing, it sounds like from what they originally said D&D Next was discussed to be to what it looks like now and where it's going, that they are actually listening to the players who are involved in the playtest, who are giving them feedback, they're reading the forums, they're reading the comments, and they're applying that.
Right. If you have been listening to the podcast for a while, you know when they really first started to mention about D&D Next that neither one of us were completely sold on it. I think there was a certain period in time where it was a sad time. There was a period of time when neither one of us were really all that amped about it. I don't think either one of us were really believing that it was going to happen.
Well, it's because they were talking about it being everything for everyone. They were like, if your 4th edition player wants to play like a 4th edition character at the table, then they can.
They can, right.
And the 1st edition player sitting next to them can play and, like a 1st edition player.
And
like
the way they started out really dealing with the playtest and...
Yes, dogs and cats living together, mass hysteria.
Yeah, and neither one of us were really into it. And frankly, starting up the D&D Next playtest, because we did it earlier...
Yes.
D&D Next playtest, and it was just so vanilla. And I know we played, maybe 4 or 5 sessions with you, me, Macy, and Adam. And
yeah.
I think one other person whose name doesn't jump out at me right now.
But I think we really just got bored with it.
And it was a matter of just having gotten bored. It was very much like 3rd edition D&D, a little stripped back. Things that and we just got bored with it, and it wasn't because we all have very similar play styles, which is not necessarily the case. We have our own likes and dislikes. The real issue was it just didn't seem like they were putting a whole lot of effort into making the game fun. Well, since we've been playing these later D&D Next playtests.
And reading up on the, you know, results of
and really
of
getting back into it
that they've done, and
for quite a while, for several months, I know neither one of us were really following that closely because, you know, it kind of put a bad taste in our mouths when it was a little, you know, boring. That's just when we started to really look into, you know, stuff like Age of Empires because it's a game that I've played literally years of my life on.
Right,
Edge of the Empire. It's which is when we started getting into that and playing some other things and developing stuff on our own and et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, once we finally picked it back up and said, hey, we should do a D&D playtest and really got the game going and got some players together, which has been now a 2 or 3 month period, sort of at the end of the playtest cycle, we're both in a very different place.
Yes. Very different.
I am looking forward to D&D Next coming out. I will definitely pick up the first player's handbook. I think it is in good hands. It's working well with people who know what they're doing. I think they'll be able to come out with a good game that we will enjoy. Now, I will likely always like, or I will always like 4th edition. I am an unabashed fan of 4th edition. Come at me if you want to. I'm an unabashed fan of 4th edition. Compared to anything else, I think there were issues with it, but it solved a lot of problems that previous editions had, and I think solved them in creative ways that made it for a fun game. And we had fun 4th edition games. I did not play a 4th edition game that I did not consider to be 100% fun at the very least. So, mission accomplished there.
Yeah.
But... D&D Next is looking pretty good, and I'm really interested and kind of back in the fold. And I know Russell is very similar to where I am with the thinking. So, bravo, Wizards of the Coast.
Yeah, and the reason why we say that we feel like they're listening to the players is because the more that we see changes come out and the more that we see things discussed, the things that wind up being that kind of making it through are some basic design elements that are from 4th edition as well as 3rd edition and a couple of other places. You have, you know, at-will abilities and encounter abilities to an extent that have made it through into the playtest. You know, they know people like that, and so they've given wizards and clerics spells that they can use all the time and feel like they're actually effective, not just, you know, little edge case spells. They've applied, you know, things to other classes so that they can actually have, you know, unique, extraordinary abilities that are part of what that are just, you know, there as a resource that they can turn on, turn off, use, don't use as necessary, and they can get a lot of use out of them. The whole optional element that they've discussed. We wind up using all the options because we want to try them out. But, you know, you can easily just say, you know, feats, the way that they have feats kind of set up now, where they're big uber changes to your overall class, you don't use them at all. You just increase your, you know, ability. Skills, you can use skills or not use skills. It seems like all these different elements, they're really nailing the point where, you know, you can turn it on, you can turn it off if you don't want to, and when you use them, they make sense. The most important thing is that they've gone to the third edition, second edition, first edition, you know, they've moved back towards that level of you can clear very, very large amounts of space and time relatively quickly. Because we did, we cleared almost the entirety of a 60-room dungeon in a couple of play sessions. We cleared about a third to a half of another dungeon in this last play session, and they're going to probably clear the entire place out today because they got to the big battle, and the big battle took a bit, and it felt, correct me if I'm wrong, that felt like an actual honest to God, you know, big boss fight, right?
Yeah.
Because you guys had been fighting, you know, kind of shadowy figures here and there, and then suddenly you were dealing with actual knockdown, drag out fights. You fought an ogre. You fought squads of hobgoblins. You fought, you know, a big boss, his pet howler, and other, you know, assorted hangers-on, you know? And those actually, I mean, they felt like good, solid threats, but they also felt like it was a manageable battle that didn't take 2 hours to complete the way that some battles in 4th edition could take.
Right.
Which is, if I have to knock 4th edition for anything, that's the biggest knock that I have. Is yeah, because damage was
tended to take a while. I don't think damage and HP were quite as optimized as they should have been. There should have either been there should have either been less HP or more damage. I understand where they were going. They wanted to give players more of an opportunity to do things. And it really, because I know there have been issues with third edition where you go in and basically where you can go in and, especially if you have a wizard or a sorcerer in the party, you go in and one shot the big bad and go,
yeah,
you're dead.
Yep.
Which sucks, but you know they did, I think, take it a little too far in the other direction.
But it feels, at least at this point in the game, that they are hitting the right balance with that, you know, kind of halfway point between third and fourth, where you have the ability and the utility that you have in fourth, but you have the speed and simplicity in some circumstances as you have in third.
Right.
And then they took the elements of both, you know, like wonky rules and scenarios to try to get to try to sim and get stuff done, like grapple and everything else, and then chop those off from third. The really overblown out damage and hit points from fourth edition, they've chopped those off. So that's, you know, I'm looking forward. There are adventures that are either coming out or that we haven't run, including old school adventures, you know, that I'm honestly really looking forward to. Like, you got the Isle of Dread, the old school Isle of Dread. I think the old school Tomb of Horrors as well in one of the last playtest packets. No reason why you couldn't try running through those. Conversion, from my point as a DM, is still supremely easy since everything for the monsters runs off of their ability scores. Everything runs off the ability scores. You can add in one or two little bits of flavor here and there the way you did in 4th edition, but it's if Wizards did anything at all to really make things easier on DMs and D&D Next, they would do the same thing that has been done in 13th Age, and they would provide a basic block of, if you want a pre-statted up monster at first level, here is what it looks like. It has 5 hit points, it has 14 or 13 AC, it has these stats, you know, like 12, 10, 10, 12, 8. It has this speed, it has this this attack that deals a d8, and this is its bonus. And it provides that for every single level. And then it says, if you want one that is a, you know, that's the 10 XP. If you want the 20 XP threat, here is one that has more hit points, it hits a little harder, and has a little better stats. If you want the 40 XP threat, the really tough guy, here is what it looks like. And it puts those tables out. And those are flat, vanilla, you know, stock monsters. And you can take them. You can adjust one or two things here or there for what you want.
Sprinkle on top, a little flavor.
Dust it with, you know, spells or magic items. Done. Because 13th Age does that, and it's phenomenal as far as making stuff. I can make unique monsters in 5 minutes. if they did that for next, hands down, sold.
Yeah,
done.
Absolutely.
Day one. And as far as the books go, the interesting thing is that what we're seeing is that there's not a lot of bloat in terms of what you get out of the actual, you know, page count of the book itself.
Mm-hmm.
Ghost of Dragonspear Castle has, you know, it's really thick. It's, I would say, about as thick as a rule manual usually is when it comes out. But most of that, like three quarters of that, is all background and adventure.
Mm-hmm.
The last quarter of the book, barely 50 plus pages, are all the rules you need as a player and as a DM. I mean, you count the spell book in there, and that'll probably bump up to like 100 once you get it all said and done with
right.
equipment and everything else. And even then, that is a fraction
mm-hmm.
of the size of what you've gotten out of past books. I'm thinking they're going to break the cycle of the whole, here is the player's handbook, here is the monster manual, here is the Dungeon Master's Guide.
Yeah.
I think they're going to get to the point where they say, here is one book, it is the core book. It is everything that a Dungeon Master and that a player needs to create games and run games. And it's all in the same book. And then they say, here is this optional book if you want to mm-hmm. play with a very, you know, third edition, fourth edition style, which is what they're discussing right now on Mike Merle's blog about what the other design teams are working on.
Mm-hmm.
You know, here is another book that is all about storytelling, that's all about role-playing. And then those are the optional books that they wind up selling.
Which is good, because that's more stuff that everyone can use at the table.
Yes.
It's better than something like Arcane Power, where only people who are interested in arcane characters... You know, take Adam, for example. Adam is really good in these situations, because Adam plays two types of characters that I know of. He plays rogues. He occasionally will play a barbarian.
Yep.
Or a type of barbarian. I've never seen Adam play an arcane caster... I'm sure he has in the past, but I would hazard to say that Adam is not super interested in arcane casters as far as playstyle is concerned. He's never going to need to buy Arcane Power. It's not a book for everybody. He has no reason to buy it. Now, you don't want to go back to the third edition style of doing books, which I believe you can technically term being write all the things. Write everything you can think of and we'll put out a new book.
Right.
And wait, why would anybody want to buy this book? Because it has D&D on it. Write the book.
Yeah.
So you get ridiculous books that absolutely nobody wants or needs or will ever use. So I like the idea. I will, though, point out that Edge of the Empire, one book.
Yep.
There's no other book in that I'm aware of.
They have other books that are coming. But,
yeah, but we're playing an Edge of the Empire game using the rule book, and it's the only book that any of us have. So it can be done, and it can be fun, and it can work really well.
And the thing is that there are, like Edge of the Empire, I think Pathfinder does it too, there's a couple of other systems that have all-in-one books, but those books are also massive.
Mm-hmm.
Like Edge of the Empire is no slouch. I think it's bigger than the... Fourth edition Player's Handbook.
Oh yeah, it is, but it's all three books.
So
and we expect it to be a little bigger.
Right. What I'm saying is, I think with the system that they have, especially the core basic, you know, system,
it'll be like a much smaller book, but a singular
much
book.
Book. And that's honestly, I'm excited about that.
Yeah,
I think that that's great. I think that that's needed at this point. And frankly, I think that that will get more. New people mm-hmm. into D&D,
which, especially if
at
they
the end of the day,
price point better.
Yes, at the end of the day, that's gotta be what you need to survive. You have to be able to introduce absolutely brand new people to D&D, mm-hmm. and you have to have, you know, a low enough barrier of entry, both on the rule side of things and the money side of things, that they can get involved and that they get like, holy crap, they get the bug, and then they've got to buy the other stuff, and that's where you can make your money and
right.
help yourself. But you don't necessarily have to have, you know, like, I'm going to say this. Pathfinder was like a $60, $65 basic book,
mm-hmm.
and it's not for new people. It's for people who have played D&D and who want to recapture third edition.
Mm-hmm.
And there is a market for that, and that market has proved to be successful for Paizo.
And very loud.
That is not a successful way to move things forward.
No.
For the hobby as an overall mm-hmm. rule. I think that what Wizards is doing, and I think if we see that with the book that comes out with D&D next, it will be a very important and necessary step to move the overall hobby forward. Mm-hmm. And there are other aspects and elements to it, but this is still the flagship. This is still the brand. This is still, you know, the cornerstone that people look to. You can get involved in the other types like Savage World or the Cortex systems or Age or all the different kinds of systems that are out there, but those rarely, I would say, are, you know, what get people interested. When people get interested, they want to say, I want to play Dungeons & Dragons. I was like, what are you guys playing? Dungeons & Dragons.
Right.
Because that's it's the cultural touchstone.
It is the Kleenex of RPGs.
It is. It absolutely is. And it is the gateway drug to all those other things.
It is. Because, I mean, that was what I started playing. And yeah. Now I've branched out and played many other systems, but I didn't start off wanting to play many other systems. I started off wanting to play D&D. Or I found people who played D&D and wanted to play D&D. It, I think, captures people unlike anything that comes before it or after it. Not only because it has the history, not only because it's a thing that everyone, even people who don't understand it, sort of understand it. And, you know, it's like Coke. In the South, we occasionally get made fun of because some among us will call all sodas Cokes. If you go to a restaurant and say, what would you like? I'd like a Coke. Oh, really? What kind of Coke? Dr. Pepper. If you're not from the South, that makes no sense. You're right. Like, wait, but you
are. Or they have to make sure and ask. It's like, I like a Coke. We have Dr. Pepper, Coke, Sprite. You know, they go through that list.
Right. Instead of saying, Sprite.
I'd like a pop. I'd like a soda.
Right.
I'd like tea. D&D they assume you want sweet tea.
D&D there's no other type of tea. I don't even know what you're talking about. Exactly. D&D is like that. You can say, oh, you guys want to get together and play D&D? Sure. Well, what do you want to play? Oh, let's play Edge of the Empire. You know, you could.
Maybe not necessarily that much, but still.
You could conceivably get to that point.
Yes, and I'm going to propose something even crazier if, you know, people aren't already trying to find me and, you know, just be like, you don't like Pathfinder? I
don't like Pathfinder either.
I think that it is not only better, but necessary for the survival of all those other things.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah,
that D&D does well.
I agree.
I think that it is imperative, and that they, from a business perspective, want D&D to do well. More people get involved in the hobby. More people get introduced to it, and from there, they filter out. They pick up, you know, the Margaret Weiss games. They pick up the Dragon Age RPGs. They go to Pathfinder if that's what they want to do because they know people who are really playing it. But I think that you're going to get the biggest impact overall if D&D Next does well. And from what we're seeing, I think that they are in a position that they could bring this sucker home for a landing and stick it.
Yeah, I agree. And people might think, oh, well, these are better systems. These are whatever, you know. I might even grant you that. From sheer gameplay perspective, there doesn't necessarily have to be a best system. But maybe there is a system out there that is better, in quotes, than D&D. However, D&D has the megaphone. You're not going to find out about Elder Scrolls legend and lore of the 19th Kingdom 6th edition that's the best ever created. Because, you know what? The only people who know about that game are people who already play that game. You need to get people interested, and D&D has that thing that other games don't. So yeah. It's important for D&D to exist. And I say this at one point in time, knowing I might never say it again, I feel like it's going to. I think they're going to have a launch. You're going to have the Pathfinder Paizo Grognard sitting there going, oh, Pathfinder's blah, 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 blah. But you're also going to have a healthy segment of the population that goes out there and embraces it, just like 4th edition. Remember how everyone fucking hated 4th edition before it came out? Still did pretty well. Still sold well. Still had tons of people that played it, and that's what you're going to get.
I think if we have cautionary tales, you know, kind of looking forward to that, these are the biggest cautionary tales. First, as we've mentioned, don't write all the books.
Yeah.
Don't put out, you know, a glut, a freaking, right. God, Normus just, ah. If you want to do that, make them adventures.
Treat it like games and DLC. Games and DLC work really well, because I know people who love games, never buy DLC. I know people who love games, buy all the DLC. There are just different people out there. Some people want to spend money on something one time and play it.
And for the love of Vecna, do not, I repeat, do not pull that Essentials crap on us again.
Stick with your product. Don't try and do that shit again. That was
fucking
ridiculous.
Don't create brand confusion. Don't just, so many things that were wrong with that.
Don't shoot yourself in the foot.
The only good thing that came out of that was the little, you know, the one bound paperback copy of the rules that had the FAQs in it. That was useful.
Mm-hmm.
Everything else
was just ridiculous.
Burn it to the ground.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. There were good things that come out. Put them elsewhere as options. Mm. And actually make them legitimate options off of the core game, which is what they are doing. Instead of saying, we put out this very complex system, we're now going to put out a secondary, easier, quote-unquote, system.
Right.
Instead, they're starting, here is our core system. Here are all the things that you can build onto that core, like aftermarket components onto a computer.
Here's your complex versions. Here's your even simpler versions.
Possibly even. And they've already kind of built that in. It's like, you don't want feats? Don't use them. You don't want skills? Don't use them. You can play that stripped down level of D&D with the core set straight up. But if you want the more complex, you can buy more books.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, frankly, that's the smarter model, because it fits more with what, you know, people are going to be around the table. A lot of people are going to get in, they're going to want to learn to play, and they're going to play simply, and a whole lot of games are going to be run simply. And then you're going to have either the handful of people or the handful of games that are going to say, we want more complexity, and they're going to go out and they're going to buy it.
This is what you're going to have. This is exactly what's going to be said at game tables across the world. You're going to hear, oh, that's really cool. Page turn. Oh, that's really cool. And that's how it begins.
Yep.
So to wrap everything up, we're both in the camp now. So we will welcome ourselves back into the fold. If you're interested in what we're talking about, it requires no money to go and play the playtest document. There's no charge whatsoever. So go to wizards.com/D&D. D, letter D, letter N, letter D. And join the playtest. You can still do it. You can still download the playtest documents. You own them. They come to you in a folder of PDFs that no one will ever be able to take away from you. And read through it. Make a character. Get a group together and start playing. Even if they're no longer taking playtest information, it's a good idea of what you'll get in D&D Next. And if you like it, when D&D Next comes out, hopefully in a nice thin tome that is, you know, $30 or so, then pick it up and play it. And I think you will be much better off. You'll feel much better off. And you'll have a lot of fun. Which is really, at the end of the day, the one thing we've never wavered on. All of these games, specifically D&D, which is near religious for Russell and myself.
Yep.
It's important that those games are fun. And it's fun. We're having lots of fun. We have a chicken that has a hat and chainmail.
Yes.
It's hard to overlook how much fun that is. But for now, we're going to leave you. Go to wizards.com/D&D. Download the playtest document. Give it a look-see. It's completely free. Let us know what you think. You can shoot us an email to girpodcast@gmail.com. You can also hit us up on Twitter. We are @girpodcast. As always, our music is Op Prop featuring Esset. Check them out on uhort.no. For Russell, this is Jeremy. Thanks for listening.
And we roll for initiative. Cyrelk, use your holy spells to heal them. Diord, get in there and turn yourself into a dog or whatever.